Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Adam Becker. He's a science writer with a PhD in astrophysics, and we're talking about his latest book, What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics. Adam, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I read a lot, and this is going to sound strange to people, but I read a lot of books on quantum theory. I'm really interested in it and quantum physics. But this is not your typical book on quantum physics at all. And I want to talk to people. I want to make sure the audience knows that. Ultimately, this is a book about how science works and it evolves and the relationship of science and philosophy. How did you come to write this book?
That's a good question. You're right. I'm a little biased, of course, having written the book, but I think you're right. It is a little unusual for a book on quantum physics. How did I come to write this book? I grew up reading a lot of popular science books, and a lot of them talked about quantum physics. And I thought, okay, you know, this sounds really strange and interesting, and I'm excited to learn more about it. And some of the things that these books say don't make a lot of sense to me, but I'm sure it'll make sense once I learn the subject in, you know, a college course. And I thought the same thing about other areas of physics as well. Like, you know, gosh, these things that they say about relativity don't make a lot of sense to me. And then I learned relativity and I thought, oh, okay, actually this makes a lot of sense now. And then I took a quantum physics course, and instead of feeling, you know, that sort of same sense of understanding and illumination, I just felt like I understood even less. Like, I knew how to use the theory, I understood the mathematics, but I didn't understand what the heck was going on. And I started asking questions. And at that point, some of my professors got upset or angry defensive, and other professors said, yeah, no, that's a good question, and there aren't a lot of good answers. And so that sort of sent me down the rabbit hole. And, one professor, actually, when I asked him what he thought was an annoying question about quantum physics, he said, well, if that's the kind of question you're interested in, then why don't you go to the philosophy department? Which he clearly thought this was a withering insult. And I could tell that, but I went to the philosophy department and I started getting some answers and started finding out that there was a very strange history here and started looking for a book on the subject. And when I didn't find one, I thought, well, you know, maybe I should write one.
It's fascinating because, like I said, I've read a lot of books on quantum theory. I have never read a book about the relationship of the sort of dissidents with quantum theory, or the people who wanted to ask those questions, and the so-called purists, the Copenhagen interpretation people. And you bring up their reaction to this. I mean, this includes people like Robert Oppenheimer, who, when people ask certain questions, is like, yeah, okay, never mind. And the phrase that it's used is shut up and calculate.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be clear, quantum physics works extraordinarily well. So, you know, calculating with it is a good idea. It's the shut up part that I don't like. You know, this idea that, you know, we have this theory that works incredibly well. It is the foundation of so much of our modern technology. It explains so many things about, you know, the features of the world around us, the everyday world, not just, you know, the world of the things we're made of, not just atoms. And you know, it's this beautiful theory mathematically. You know, when you learn the math, you think, gosh, this is a stunning theory. And it explains so much. And then you ask, okay, and what's going on here? You know, what's going on with electrons or atoms when we're not looking? How do they behave? Which seems like a very simple question. And the standard answer you get to that is shut up and calculate. And it's not even a sort of shut up and calculate because we don't, you know, that's a complicated question and we'll get to it later, or shut up and calculate because we don't have a good answer to that, but I'm sure some answer will come. It's sort of like a moralistic shut up and calculate. You should shut up because that's a stupid question. And it's wrong of you to ask it. It indicates that there's something wrong with you as a scientist. You're a bad scientist.
Bad scientist.
And bad scientist. No cookie. And there's just no reason you should be asking that question. It's an unreasonable and unscientific question. And that is just sort of clearly wrong. It's an unsatisfactory thing.
Yours is the first book to center around that conflict. And I want to give the audience at least a taste of what we're talking about. Because the great thing about your book is it builds sequentially on itself and it makes logical sense as it proceeds along. But what we're talking about is the so-called Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. Now, who are the physicists involved? We're talking about the origins of quantum theory. Who are they? Who are the people involved?
Yeah. So quantum physics isn't like relativity. It wasn't just, developed by one person. It was developed by a team of physicists over the course of the first quarter of the 20th century. And the key people involved were people like... Well, Einstein was one of them, but he was not the central figure. The central people involved were people like Bohr, people like, Niels Bohr, Danish physicist, Werner Heisenberg,
right.
German physicist, Erwin Schrödinger, Austrian, Louis Dubois, French. So it's this international team of basically all-star physicists coming together and working on this incredible theory and developing it to explain these very strange results that were being found about the world of the ultra tiny, the world of atoms and subatomic particles. And the sort of spiritual leader of the group, the center of the group was this Danish physicist, Niels Bohr, who, came up with one of the most important developments in the early days of quantum physics, what's known as the Bohr model of the atom. Like if you ever see a picture of an atom, on someone's T-shirt or in some 1950s movie, it looks like the Bohr model of the atom. It's the nucleus with the electrons orbiting around it. That's what Bohr came up with. Before that, we didn't have that picture of what atoms were. And that picture is incomplete, as Bohr himself well knew, but it was still a major breakthrough, and it led to full theories of quantum physics later on.
And for people who aren't familiar, well, let me stop you there, because the general audience, there's a difference. When we observe things like planets and just things, normal objects around us, we're talking Newtonian physics, the physics of big objects. When you get down to the quantum level, when we get down to the subatomic level, things behave weirdly. They always have, and the mathematics is bizarre, and quantum theory was supposed to sort of sort that out. But come to find out that, it does. It's a great predictive model, but there are some odd things about it that people over the decades have asked about. One of them is the measurement problem. What's that?
Right. Okay, so... Basically, like you were saying, we have this wonderful physics for the everyday world around us, this Newtonian physics, but it doesn't seem to work for the world of atoms. And quantum physics does, but it has this host of problems. so one of the problems is the central sort of equation, the central law of quantum physics is this thing called the Schrödinger equation, developed by this physicist, Erwin Schrödinger. And that equation describes the way that things behave in the quantum world, but it doesn't apply all of the time, the way that we think laws of nature, should. And it's not clear when it applies. In particular, it seems like it applies all of the time except when we look at something in the quantum world. When we make a measurement of something in the quantum world, suddenly the Schrödinger equation is suspended, and this other thing called the Born rule comes in, and it doesn't really matter what that is. It's just not the Schrödinger equation. And it says that all of a sudden these objects behave differently, and then once we make the measurement, when we stop looking, the Schrödinger equation suddenly applies again. And this is very strange and disturbing because it's not clear what we mean by a measurement, and it's not clear what measurement should have to do with the fundamental laws of nature at the smallest scales. You know, is a measurement when I make a measurement? Does it not apply, you know, does this not apply to everybody else? And if so, you know, why does it seem like quantum physics applies to more than one person? You know, that, that clearly can't be the answer.
And as the title of your book says, the central problem everybody starts to ask is then what is real? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Like, what's really going on here? What objects are real?
Does that mean if I don't look at this object
in the world?
Yeah. And Schrodinger's the thought problem of Schrodinger's cat, which he did sort of as a joke, but it still gets to the central problem of it. You know, that you have this cat in a box. Well, I'll let you describe it. The famous cat in the box with the radioactive decay problem is we don't know whether the cat is alive or dead until we open the box, and it takes one state. So it's in both states simultaneously until we observe it.
Right. Because if you take this idea that, you know, the Schrodinger equation applies except when you look, Schrodinger himself pointed out that can't be the whole story, because if that were the whole story, then, you know, you could set up this contraption where you have a radiation detector in a box with a cat and a very slightly radioactive source, and you set it up so that if the radiation detector detects radiation, then it will, you know, release a hammer that smashes a vial of poison and kill the cat. But if quantum stuff, you know, obeys different rules when we look, and in particular, if it doesn't sort of enter a particular state until we look, which is the usual way of talking about quantum physics, then that means that the radiation from this slightly radioactive source is not emitted or you know, not emitted. There isn't a fact of the matter about whether it's emitted or not until we look, which means that it's both emitted and not emitted when we don't look, which means that the radiation detector both goes off and doesn't go off, which means that the cat is both dead and alive until we open the box. And Schrodinger said, look, you know, maybe atoms behave in this strange way, but cats definitely don't. Cats are either dead or alive at all times, and us opening the box to look at the cat doesn't make the cat dead or alive. That's not how this works, so there must be something missing in our understanding here. It doesn't mean the theory's wrong. We're just not done yet.
And getting back to the Copenhagen interpretation, they would be saying, don't worry your head about Schrodinger's cat. Just shut up and calculate. Don't ask those questions.
Yeah, basically they'd say, you know, this is a silly example. This is not something that we need to worry about. This is not something that is even meaningful. They would say, you know, all variety of sort of vague and contradictory things like, you know, we can't talk about what's going on with the cat in the box before we open the box because we don't know what's going on in the box. We can't see what's going on in the box, and things we can't see are meaningless. So it's meaningless to talk about what's going on with the cat in the box before we open it, which is absurd. There are all kinds of things that we can't see that are meaningful to talk about. You know, like the answer to the question, is the couch in the living room even when I'm not there? Yeah, the couch is in the living room.
No, it's not.
When you're not there.
Not until you look. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Adam Becker, a science writer with a PhD in astrophysics, and we're talking about his latest book. It is one of the best books on science this year. What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics. Adam, the bulk of your book, it sets out sort of the lives of these people who can be described as quantum dissidents, people who did ask questions or offered up some ways to solve these problems and who were usually shut down. And each one is like a worth a book in and of themselves. And I'm only going to talk about a few of them. David Bohm, B-O-H-M. What did he bring to the table on reacting to this, the problems of quantum physics?
Yeah, Bohm, David Bohm is just a fascinating character. And
his life is wild. His life is incredible. I never knew anything about it until I read your book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he deserves to be much more widely known. That's why I wrote about him. I mean, he did have a completely wild life, like you said. I mean, it's the kind of thing that not only is worthy of its own book, but like it's the sort of thing that you'd expect to see in a movie.
Yeah.
And it's astonishing that more people haven't heard of him. I mean, he really thought that this usual way of talking about quantum physics was inadequate, that there had to be something more to the world than just, you know, shutting up and calculating, that there must be some picture of reality that lay underneath the theory. Otherwise, you know, it seemed like a direct contradiction to him, you know, that we need to have a better and more definite picture of what's going on when we don't look. And he was right about that. And he thought, okay, there must be some better way to do this. And then he found one, which was supposed to be impossible. But he found a different way to think about quantum physics rather than just throwing up your hands and saying, oh, okay, you know, we can't talk about what atoms or subatomic particles are doing when we don't look. We can't even talk about what Schrödinger's cat is doing when we don't look. Bohm said, oh, no, there's this other way of doing things where, you know, everything just has a definite position at all times, and Schrödinger's cat is either dead or alive at all times, even before you look, and it's just that when you look at things, you learn new things about them, but that's about you, not about the world around you. And he said, you know, fundamentally, the world is made of particles that are guided along by things called pilot waves that, you know, guide their motion through the world. And this turned out to be completely reasonable and to reproduce
silly boy
the results of normal quantum physics. And so he thought, okay, you know, this is going to be something that people will find interesting and acceptable, and maybe it'll even replace the usual way of talking about quantum physics. But then life got in the way.
Oh my God, did he get? He got accused of being a communist by the House of Un-American Activities, and he was essentially banished and lived in Brazil for most of his life.
For a few years after this, he was coming up with this theory while he was waiting for his day in court. He was cleared on all charges, but then he was blacklisted because it was the height of the Red Scare in 1951. Man. And he tried to find a job somewhere else in the U.S. or in Europe. Couldn't find a job anywhere, even though he had recommendation letters from Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer. And he ultimately, yeah, as you said, he ended up going to Brazil, and then he was trapped in Brazil. He got to Brazil, and a few weeks later, the American consulate there summoned him and then illegally confiscated his passport, and it meant he couldn't leave the country for almost 5 years after that. So many
of these people have interesting backstories. Another person, Hugh Everett, and I had the pleasure of interviewing his son, who's the lead of the band The Eels. I love The Eels too. But Hugh Everett, what an interesting story that was, and what happened to him. One of the ways he came, he started thinking about sort of doing an end run around the Copenhagen interpretation, ended up leading to the many worlds interpretation. What was that?
Well, so yeah, Hugh Everett said, you know, this is ridiculous. This Schrödinger equation really seems like it should just apply at all times. And the problem with that is, if you say the Schrödinger equation applies at all times, then it looks like Schrödinger's cat is both dead and alive. And then when you look at it, you see both a dead, there's two copies of you. You split and you see both a living cat and a dead cat. And Everett, you know, sort of goaded on by this sort of prankster impulse that he had that seemed to be a fundamental part of his personality.
You call him a dark jester, which is a great phrase. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah, he was. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, when Niels Bohr, this godfather of quantum physics, came to visit Princeton, where Everett was in graduate school in the mid-1950s, Everett ended up getting drunk with one of Bohr's assistants and another one of the graduate students. And the three of them got into this drunken argument about quantum physics, where Bohr's assistant was sort of, you know, promoting this shut up and calculate line. And Everett was saying, no, you know, that's ridiculous. And then when he woke up the next morning, you know, presumably with some sort of headache, instead of deciding, you know, that was all a drunken mistake, he doubled down and he made this his PhD thesis. Yeah, and the thing is, it's really a wild idea, but it really has a sort of mathematical elegance to it, and it could very well be correct.
It means that at many, many points along your timeline and everybody else's timeline, it sort of branches. And you're following one complicated branching, and then there's many, many other versions of you in these many worlds interpretation. And again, the backstory of you, Everett, is bizarre because he ends up leaving physics and just becomes this sort of wild government functionary.
Yeah. I mean, he was not that interested in the academic life, and this, you know, chilly reception that his ideas received certainly dissuaded him from it if he had any, you know, further ambitions in that direction. Because, you know, Bohr and the other people in Copenhagen, they hated his ideas. and he wanted things that the academic life couldn't give him. You know, he was a product of the mid-1950s. He wanted a madman lifestyle. You know, he wanted money and women and booze and fine food. You know, that's what he was into. And so he went off and started working for the military industrial complex as a guy who sort of gamed out different nuclear war scenarios. He actually worked with a guy who was the inspiration for Dr. Strangelove.
And the amazing thing is, wasn't there some kind of, you know, everybody sort of ignored the many worlds theory for a while. Then people started thinking about it again, going, you know, there is something here. So they were having a conference and they finally realized, couldn't we get Everett here to talk about it? And they just sort of called him up and said, can you fly in for this conference and talk about it? And he did.
Yeah. He was always happy to talk about it if people asked him to. But, you know, for a long time,
he didn't talk about it to anybody.
Yeah, he didn't talk about it to anybody. It was one of the best kept secrets in physics. He was not someone who sought, you know, public speaking. He'd do it if people asked him to, but it was not, you know, his favorite thing to do.
Now, there's so many other people in this book, including, very importantly, John Stuart Bell. And we're going to run out of time, so I don't want to start talking about Bell's theorem because, and as you mentioned in the book, it's called The Most Profound Discovery in Science. This whole story, you talk about, I mean, the way that the people who believe in the Copenhagen interpretation react to these people asking questions and offering different ideas, it's almost psychotic. As a matter of fact, I think he's used that word. It's not, you know, maybe not exactly psychotic, but it's pretty damn close. And for that in science is pretty bizarre. And to this day, most textbooks teach the Copenhagen interpretation.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really quite puzzling. I mean, it's honestly, it's a historical accident. And I mean, it is true that you can get far by shutting up and calculating. You know, there's a lot of good science you can do that way. But if you want to start asking deeper questions, there's no reason why you can't do that, and a lot of good reasons why you should. And a lot of, you know, more and more physicists today, thankfully, are starting to question this sort of historical baggage that the theories come with and start to say things like, you know, if we're really struggling to come up with the next theory to go beyond quantum physics, and we are, then, you know, it's time that we took a closer look at why we believe the things that we believe. And when you take a closer look at this in particular, you know, it just sort of turns to sand. There's no reason to believe in the Copenhagen interpretation. You can do more than shut up and calculate. You can do a lot more.
And this brings up probably one of the most fascinating aspects of your book is how science, not only has how science evolves, but the relationship of and the important relationship between philosophy and physics. And as you talk about, several very important physicists, again, people I admire, people like Stephen Hawking, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Lawrence Krauss are very anti-philosophy. Basically, they want philosophers to shut up and go away. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a contingent of physicists, especially, you know, well-known prominent physicists who have said some very silly things about philosophy and really don't appreciate its value. And honestly am puzzled by it. You know, this is one of the questions I've been getting the most when I go around and talk about this book is, you know, why are physicists so dismissive of philosophy? And I have some theories, but at the end of the day, I really don't know. You know, these are philosophers are by and large smart people doing interesting work that's related to physics. And physicists, by and large, don't notice, don't seem to care, even though whenever we do physics or whenever we do any kind of science, we're doing philosophy at the same time. I mean, it's just a question of whether or not we're explicit about it and whether or not we're honest with ourselves about it. I mean, science grew out of philosophy. And there's no way to sort of get around making philosophical judgments when you do your work as a scientist.
Do you think we're turning a corner in this, though? Do you think the Copenhagen interpretation is at least being safely questioned now?
I do. Yeah. Okay. I think that it's 30 or 40 years ago, the Copenhagen interpretation was just overwhelmingly dominant.
Yeah.
People were saying very silly things without being challenged at all about it. But now, you know, I don't even know if a majority of physicists still believe in it. I think it's at least a plurality. We need a good survey of this. Some sociologist of science should do that and make a good PhD.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I've certainly been exposed to the Copenhagen interpretation a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it shows up a lot in popular accounts of physics. It's in almost every widely used quantum physics textbook. But I think that you can certainly question it now without paying the same professional price that you used to. It's still difficult. And quantum foundations, the field that sort of goes after these questions and maintains that, no, you know, the job's not done, is still a field that, you know, has a shaky reputation within physics, but it's much, much better than it was a generation or two ago. I think that trend is going to continue.
My guest tonight has been Adam Becker, a science writer with a PhD in astrophysics. And we're talking about his latest book, an absolutely phenomenal history of a very specific science and really tracking how it evolved or neglected to evolve for a while. What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics. Adam, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.